Folks, can I have your attention for a moment here, please? Before we start today's proceedings, I want you to copy my motions entirely. You reach into your pocket, coat, purse, any other. You pick up this little instrument, you find the off button, and you press it. Right? Good. To club business first, usually you've got a great big long line of speakers to come up, and the only one I've got at the moment to tell you about is Jing Ulrich from JP Morgan, who's been here before and will be speaking on the 24th. She's one of these investment gurus, and may her pronouncements remain ambivalent and inscrutable forever, because markets have a way of proving gurus false when these things are not so. But she's well followed right around the world, in fact, and generally people, I don't know if we've got a full house for this one yet, but I expect we will. And now that's particularly appropriate here, because the topic of her speech is cultivating sustainable growth, whereas in this topic of our today's presentation, we have a feasting dragon, which surprising that Jing will have to speak about putting China on a diet to follow a feasting dragon. And as far as feasting dragon, starving eagle is concerned, I think I can always so claim to be saying some things about that. In today's column, I said that American diplomats in matters of the Middle East are proven liars. Got that one through. And that in matters of monetary discipline, the People's Bank of China is cheats. But Peter will be taking a somewhat different line here today. Peter's been a longtime club member, lawyer, writer, a regular down at the bar. And a lot of his thoughts, if you want to find out, you'd have to do no more than get down to this bar and say, Peter, what do you think about? You'll get what he's been writing about in detail. And Feasting Dragon, Starving Eagle, Peter's going to tell us a bit about why he thinks that the shoe is on one foot definitely and not on the other, and that the American consumer is a disadvantage to China's prosperity at this moment. At least I expect that's what he will tell us. There you go, he will. Peter.
Thanks, Jake, for that introduction. And it's good to see so many of my classmates from the main bar downstairs that Jake is alluding to, and Bert's. I see Walter, CP, Ian, Bruce, Marty, Chris, Les, and Martin, not to mention Pamela and a few others, that we usually discuss what I refer to as the three cornerstones of human and geopolitical interaction, or what I refer to as the axis of interaction, which also applies to the relationship between China and the U.S. And in addition to the classmates that are here, there are two other classmates I just want to make a special mention of, and they are the two classmates that are memorialized at the main bar downstairs, Charlie Smith, who I memorialized in my first book, Custom Made Spin, and Hugh Van Ness, who has been memorialized in this book, which is in tribute to him. Now, before I get into the three cornerstones, I would like to see how many of you also are into these three cornerstones. So I'm going to ask you to give me a showing of hands to see if you relate to the topics that I refer to as three cornerstones. One is politics. How many of you discuss politics? Quite a few. Good. How many of you discuss religion? Even more. How many of you discuss sex? Ah, okay. I think we're going to get on fine. Now, what I said in my first book in the introduction, which is why I raised the question about these three cornerstones, is, quote, religion, politics, and sex are the three subjects we are constantly admonished not to discuss because of the emotions and passions they each evoke. Have you ever asked yourself why? Did any of you really stop and analyze the why? The question I then pose, is it possible our religious leaders, career politicians, and their enforcers have subconsciously conditioned us not to look closer at their malfeasance? I believe religion, politics, and sex are at the root and core of today's dysfunctional world disorder and the Sino-US relationship. All we have to do to just briefly look at the history to lay the groundwork for my talk. At the end of World War II, when China fought alongside the US and defeated Japan and then got independence, Mao Zedong did want to establish diplomatic relations with the US. His overtures were rejected. In fact, his communications to Roosevelt, State Department, and the communications of the various US officials on the ground never saw the light of day. The China lobby decided that it was in the interest of America, unilaterally, by the way, without any support from Congress, to continue supporting Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan. And unfortunately for Mao and America, that precedent has worked to the disadvantage of America and China, not only over the years, but today, and is one of the root causes of today's problems. That policy was not limited to China. Ho Chi Minh was also working for the US government during World War II. He was actually working for the forerunner of the CIA when he succeeded in his fight against France. At the end of the war with Japan, he also tried to establish diplomatic relations with the US, and his overtures were also rejected. Now, why do I come back to those three cornerstones? Why were these two gentlemen's overtures rejected? And not only that, but similar political agendas took place, as Jake pointed out in his column today, in Iran. It took place in Latin America, took place in the Middle East, and in Africa. And believe it or not, it does boil down to the three cornerstones I mentioned. The politics is Mao and Ho Chi Minh and others were basically communists. And commies are not what the US wants to establish diplomatic relations with. And they are also not God-fearing people. As a matter of fact, they don't believe in any religion. Where does sex come in? Basically, just screw them. We're going to do what we think is right. The point that I think is important to keep in mind is that the policy of containment and encirclement that the US has embarked on for China is not going to work. It didn't work before World War I when France and Britain tried to do the same thing to Germany with Russia. America's policy of trying to basically do the same to China today with Japan and India is not going to work. America's policy of what I refer to as black gold and guns is basically irrelevant and inapplicable to the 21st century. If America and China are truly to develop a cohesive working relationship in the interest of America and China, which is a theme I harp on in all my books, then it is time to actually sit down and look at what is really of interest to China and America right now. And for that, I have gotten into Feasting Dragon and Starving Eagle. The book was written and completed in 2009. It was sent out early last year to reviewers and just released at the end of this year. And the book really, instead of about the book, it talks about food for thought, which is what I want to discuss with you today on the relationship. And when you go to the table of contents, it is not table of contents, it is actually contents on the table. And the table itself is arranged as a menu, and it starts with a cocktail hour and goes into palate cleansers, it goes into soup, Taiwanese beef noodle, it goes into main course, political cook-offs, which deals with North Korea, and then the Chinese-American chop suey. And it ends up with cool desserts, which is about water, climate change, and the environment, two areas that also need and demand U.S.-China cooperation. There are 13 chapters here. I'm just going to focus on a couple. I'm not going to get into what a lot of the other writers here have gotten into already, whether they blame the Federal Reserve for America's problems, whether they blame bankers for subprime, and all the other issues that are debated at length. What I would like to do is focus more on the U.S.-China solutions and what I think is very timely, the visit of Hu Jintao to America and what he and President Barack Obama should be discussing and the menu they should put together with the recipes they should put together for what I believe is the new world order for Asia and the world. They have to start with what I refer to as a new menu with Sino-American fusion, a 21st century chop suey. Now, in the U.S., one of the things that happens that winds up supporting the U.S. positions towards China is what I refer to as China bashing, which is very prominent not only during election cycles, but year-round. And two examples that really highlight how bad it can get that is not really brought to the fore in the media out here is what happened in the 2000 campaign when you had Dick Cheney claiming that China is going to start drilling for oil 60 miles off the Florida coast because of a deal it had signed with Cuba, which all the media, of course, heralded and it played like wildfire. The only problem was it wasn't true. China does not have any rights to drill 60 miles off the shore of Florida, and no such agreement has ever been entered into with Cuba. To make matters worse, when the swine flu hit, Mexicans decided to pick up on America's strategy. Let's blame the Chinese for it. It was pork that was imported to Mexico from China that triggered the swine flu. There's only one problem. China doesn't export pork to Mexico. And yet, the media played it up. We have to basically stop not only the China bashing, but the deficit spending, which is something that not only have I written about and others, but the recent Simpson-Bowles bipartisan commission was basically recommending it. It was appointed by President Obama, but they couldn't even muster the 14 of the 18 votes they needed in committee to recommend it to the government. So basically what we know that America needs to cure itself, deficit spending, balanced budget, is not on the agenda. It is a lot easier to have other governments, including China, finance America's deficit spending. Now I'm going to focus on what I believe should be and can be a solution to a couple of problems in Asia. What is China's biggest issue? Taiwan. What is America's biggest issue? North Korea. Unification of Taiwan is only a matter of time. Mainland and Taiwan are getting closer. The U.S. concerns that China will attack Taiwan are unjustified. Selling arms to Taiwan while stopping Europeans from selling arms to China does not put America in a good light. In fact, it marginalizes it in the region. I believe America should reverse course and promote and expedite unity by halting military sales and support for Taiwan. By promoting unification, America can maintain its presence in the region and be a major participant in maintaining peace, stability, and prosperity, just as China can do for America in Latin America. While America is trying to contain and encircle China here, China is doing the same to America in its Latino backyard, which Monroe, in his 1823 doctrine that so vigorously defended Latin America's sphere of influence, has in fact now become China's sphere of influence. We've all read the various economic deals and oil deals and energy deals and banking deals that China's done with Latin America, but there is another area that is not widely reported. The mainland has also stepped into a void created by the U.S. policy to cut military aid to countries that refuse to exempt U.S. citizens from the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The result is the U.S. faces the prospect of losing contact with a whole generation of Latin American military officers who are now being trained by China. Meanwhile, retired Taiwanese officers are defecting to China because they receive offers of higher rank, better pay, and housing for their families. These defectors are teaching tactics on how to invade the island in China's military academy. Academies, I should say. The fact is that prosperous China can and will outspend Taiwan on weapon systems, just like America did with the Soviet Union. By the middle of the 21st century, China will probably outspend the U.S. as well if Washington doesn't change its political, economic, and military task. Some would argue, and I am one of them, that China is already financing the U.S. naval fleet's presence in the Yellow Sea. Taiwan and China are getting closer. If anyone doubts it, all one has to do is look at what Chen Xiaobian said after he was convicted and what he felt about America and its policies. And I bring this up because many people that I've discussed this subject with in the bar downstairs dispute the fact that, quote unquote, Taiwan is America's aircraft carrier to China. What did President or ex-President Chen do? He sued Barack Obama and Gates in September 2009, accusing him of failing to uphold U.S. jurisdiction over Taiwan and permitting a government in exile to illegally issue court rulings on the island. His contention was that the legitimate ruler of Taiwan is the U.S. military. Retired Army Colonel Al Wilhelm was among the first uniformed officers sent to the mainland at the height of the Cold War in the 1980s to provide advice and weaponry to the People's Liberation Army. Wilhelm is still on a mission of peace. China is going to become a superpower when what the hawks say about China having the potential to threaten America is true, retired Colonel Wilhelm said. The key, which I agree with him, is how we find a way to coexist. He says, quote, unless we develop mutual trust and friendship, it is likely my 8 grandchildren will be fighting a war against China. In my case, which is why I agree with him, I hate to see my Chinese grandchildren fight with my American grandchildren, having children in both countries. Now the question is, why can't America withdraw its support of Taiwan in exchange for China withdrawing support to North Korea? Help bring nuclear disarmament and stability to the region. Why should China encourage North Korea to disarm without a U.S. trade-off? And this, to me, is the big issue that can be resolved by both governments, since both governments have a common interest in doing so. I believe that we should forget the six-party talks. Focus on five-party talks. Cut North Korea out. What should the five-party talks between China, America, South Korea, Japan, and Russia focus on? How to basically retire Kim Jong-il and his family, either domestically or export him. This is something America is very good at. It's done so in Hawaii, Philippines, Latin America, although some may question it since the families of those former dictators seem to be returning. And I noticed yesterday Papa Doc is back in Hawaii. China, on the other hand, is very good at special economic zones, and it has the ear of Kim Jong-il. And most importantly, both China and America have the money and capital necessary to bring about an orderly transition and change. You create five economic zones, four of which border on Korea, Russia, China, and then Japan across the seas. America can help finance whatever is needed in those areas. It is not that difficult if you really stop and think about it. If the will is there and the mutual trust is there between America and China, something that hopefully will be developed further by the current visit of Hu Jintao. The other area of great cooperation is climate change. And climate change is an area that I am going to quote two members of the U.S. administration that have made comments in this area, and they're not your typical people, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm supporting them, but I just think that what they had to say is very relevant. One is Nancy Pelosi during her visit to Beijing in 2009. She is usually very anti-China, very pro-human rights, very pro-Dalai Lama, but yet during that visit to China, she said, and I quote, "We believe China and the United States can and must confront the challenge of climate change together. We have a responsibility to ourselves, to our country, to our people, and the world that works together." Another person is the U.S. ambassador to China, former governor, Utah Governor John Huntsman, who happens to be a Republican and was sent to China because he was perceived as the biggest Republican threat to Obama in the next election. So they thought they would sideline him. He happens to be a fluent Putonghua speaker, and I don't think his strategy, the Obama strategy, has worked, because I understand that John Huntsman has now bought a new home in Washington, D.C., and is exploring, quote-unquote, his political options. What he had to say is, quote, "The United States and China must be good examples and stewards of the earth. We must match economic progress with environmental stewardship. The effects of industrialization are felt worldwide," Huntsman said. Now is his and America's chance to do just that. I was delighted to hear that just before Hu Jintao left for the U.S., that an announcement was made that China and the U.S., in fact, will be cooperating on various new clean energy projects and start finding alternatives to oil. America and China are much better off trying to create a new environment, not just in the air, but politically and geopolitically, especially here in the region. America and China are better off forging a strategic partnership to prevent a bipolar nuclear world. America and China are better off working together to ensure a nuclear free Asia and Middle East. The alternative is Armageddon. America is ready for another Nixon on China. When Nixon and Mao signed the historic Shanghai Initiative in 1972, imagine an Obama-hue China-Taiwan-North Korea communique. on the very subject I have just discussed. That option is open. U.S. foreign policy can no longer afford to ignore or alienate China, either politically or economically. U.S. domestic policy can no longer afford to ignore China and to continue China bashing in the domestic political arena. It is time the blame for America's economic problems is put in the right place, and that is Washington, D.C. A Shanghai Communique 4 or Washington Communique 1 is long overdue. Hopefully, Presidents Barack Obama and Hu Jintao will lay the foundation stones for such a communique during Hu Jintao's current visit to the U.S. Thanks.
That covers a fair bit of territory. Who has questions, comments? Raise your hand. Take a seat, Peter.
Jim Seymour, Chinese University of Hong Kong. I think you need to review certain aspects of your understanding of history. You said the United States decided to defend Chiang Kai-shek. Actually, the United States decided not to defend Chiang Kai-shek. Dean Acheson drew the perimeter outside of which the United States had no interest. He drew that line east of Taiwan and east of Korea. And then came the invasion of South Korea from the north, and that changed everything. And that is the sort of festering problem that is the central issue, the hottest issue between the United States and China. And you suggested, as I understand it, trading Taiwan for North Korea. That's a little Machiavellian for me. I think that you point out, or you claim, that Taiwan is drifting toward unification with China. But this is Ma Ying-jeou. Ma Ying-jeou's standing in the polls is extremely low. He does not have the Taiwan people with him, and Taiwan is a democracy. They will never put up with that kind of unification if it means Taiwan being brought within the communist system.
We ought to spend more time downstairs in the main bar, because these are the kind of discussions I get into with others. I always reserve the right to be wrong, but I also reserve the right to respectfully disagree. And where I take issue with you is recently declassified information shows and confirms that MacArthur in Japan actually approved and authorized Japanese troops fight alongside Chiang Kai-shek against the communists because they are commies. And I think from all the historical reading that I have done, it is very clear that basically America decided it was going to stick with Chiang Kai-shek and it was going to basically build a military base in Taiwan. That's not why he fired him. He didn't fire him because he told the Japanese to go fight alongside Chiang Kai-shek. He fired him because he wanted to nuke China. We have to look at why he was fired. I mean, MacArthur got a little out of hand there, so we have to look at the underlying reasons. And that's why I say I'd love to have these ongoing discussions with you at the bar downstairs, because that's what makes for a good cocktail hour, as I point out in the book.
All right, let's have a few others who might take issue with Peter, and you can't refer it to the main bar. Marty.
Getting back to Taiwan, I have to confess to having a soft spot, having lived there for 10 years, and I really can't see the overwhelming advantage of Taiwan unifying with China just now. Rather like Li Denghui's formulation that Ma Ying-jeou himself reiterated recently, that we'll talk about reunification as soon as China has full and democratic elections. And while they've got 1,500 you know, missiles pointed at Taiwan. And I wonder how many military targets there are in Taiwan that justify 1,500 missiles. It's just not nice. It's just not a nice thing to do to your neighbor. And especially seeing you're talking about being related. You don't do that to your kith and kin. It's all just too nasty. So the status quo, which the majority of people in Taiwan who have actually visited China will say, it's a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. There's no advantage to changing the status quo just yet.
Like I said, unification is a matter of time. I did not say either country is ready for it yet, because I don't think they are. What I get into in more detail in the book, because it's a comment that both of you have addressed, is that the one country, two system model that works for Hong Kong can work between Taiwan and China. I don't think there's any question that both sides will eventually reunite. The only question is when and under what circumstances. And I can't disagree with either one of you that the quote-unquote Taiwanese, as opposed to the Chinese, are not ready or willing for that reunion now. However, if you look at all the religious or major religious leaders and major industrialists, they are advocating reunification, and the discussions taking place between both parties are tackling that very issue. Will it happen tomorrow? No. Will it happen quicker if the U.S. were to say to Taiwan, guess what, guys? We're not going to come to your defense if you declare independence. You're on your own. And guess what, guys? Per Reagan's 1982 communique, we're not going to sell you any more arms. I think that'll bring about reunification a lot quicker and on terms that both sides agree to, and will make China a lot more amenable to talking to North Korea to end that problem on that front. That is the point I was making regarding Taiwan and China. As long as the U.S. keeps promoting arms sales and claims it'll come to the defense of Taiwan, that does not serve U.S.-China relations.
Before we continue, I've forgotten my watch. What time is it, Peter?
It's almost 10:02.
Okay, we've got a good 10 minutes here anyways. Yes?
You mentioned about the misunderstanding of the press about China in the United States, which we can understand. But when the two countries, U.S. and China, if they cooperate, get together, what will the Japanese think and the Korean think? It seems nowadays India, Korea, South Korea, and then Japan, they don't want the two countries get together. How can America deal with this problem?
That's a good question, and that's what makes geopolitics so much fun for those of us who are political scientists. Every country does what it perceives to be in its best national interest. It is not in Japan's national interest to see China and the U.S. become friends. It is not in India's national interest to see the two become friends. However, let's look at what's in the best interests of the U.S. and China, not Japan and India. And if we look at what is in the best interest of those two countries, you look at who is America's number one banker among those three. It's China. You look at who wants to buy a lot of the high-tech products that the U.S. produces, that the U.S. now only sells to Japan and some to Korea and India. By basically making China, admitting China as a market economy and opening up some of the banned products that can be sold, the deficit can be reduced dramatically. The fear is, well, they'll get all this technology that America has that China can't get. Well, China's getting it anyway if it's not from Europe or other sources. And all one has to do is look at how far China has come without direct American support. whether it's on the supercomputer, whether it's on planes, whether it's on drones, you look at any of those fields, China's doing fine with non-American products. So how does that benefit America? Talk about a deficit, talk in trade, you talk about deficit spending, a lot of it on military in this area. It is in America's best interest and China's best interest to work together. And you know what? Japan, Korea, and India will fall into line as long as they know that America's in the region and has a presence here and is not excluded from the region. What is happening, the way America is trying to remain in the region by forming an alliance with Japan and trying to encircle China within trying to drag India along that's not really interested, is not in the interest of America or China. And I think if you talk to a lot of the politicians in the States, as I do, they agree. They don't understand why is it that America is such a strong ally of Japan that bombed America and so anti-China, the country that fought alongside America to defeat Japan. And that's a huge disconnect. And again, you just have to attribute it to the right lobbying by the right companies in the US and Taiwan. I mean, they've done a very good job, and Japan. I mean, if you look at the three biggest countries that spend the most money in lobbying in DC, besides Israel, it's Taiwan and Japan, followed by Saudi Arabia. So the money that's spent there conditioning people to vote the way they want is not in the best interest of Americans or Chinese.
Thank you very much. My name is John Antweiler. I work for Wells Fargo Bank. I enjoyed your talk very much. I do have a question. It seemed in your presentation, I haven't read your book, but I will, that you're sort of painting the picture that most of what we have today is the fault of American policy and not Chinese policy or Chinese reaction to American policy. My question is, do you see there being major Chinese policy fails, major reactions by the Chinese to American policy that you think are equally part of the problem?
It depends on whether you're looking at domestic policies or international policies, vis-a-vis the U.S. and the outside world. I point out in the book, I have a subheading called Banana Party Split, which talks about the division within the Communist Party between the quote-unquote elitists out of Shanghai and basically the Hu Jintao faction that is more proletariat and deals with the fact that the money should be spread more evenly across the country rather than just in the cities. I don't think one can deny there is an ongoing difference of opinion politically within the Communist Party, as there is with all political parties. And what role that plays in each one exerting their power vis-a-vis the military, as was pointed out with this great debate with Gates' recent visit here, is there a connect or a disconnect between the civilians and the military? I think China, like America, is going to do what it thinks is best for China. I mean, every country and every political leader in that country does what they think is best for their country, and then they react accordingly to what others do. Now, you're right. I do believe that a lot of the problems in America are caused because of U.S. policies, both domestic policies, whether it's subprime, or international policies, as the list I mentioned. And I think that is the major cause for China reacting the way it has reacted, which is, yes, its currency is at a higher value than it should be, but if the shoe were on the other foot, what would America do? This is a question I always ask myself. America, like any other country, always wants its potential political adversary to do what it thinks is in its best interest. How it positions that argument depends on how smart the spin doctors are putting that argument across. China has basically done what is good for China. It's sitting on over $3 trillion of in reserves. Its economy is booming. It has lifted more people out of poverty than any other country in the history of the world. That doesn't mean it doesn't have problems. We realize that. And yes, has it made some mistakes in the region by assuming it is a little overconfident or behaved over with a little extra arrogance, whether it's what it does in the Yellow Sea, what it's done with South Korea, what it's done with Japan, what it's done with Vietnam? Sure, mistakes have happened, but they've been acknowledged. And I think that is one of the strong points that I sense being over here, is that we hear a lot quicker of any quote-unquote mistakes of policies that may have taken place, whether it's China or Japan, than we do in America. In America, it becomes a debate and a fight to the death between both parties that has nothing really to do with policy. It has to do with re-election.
You're and getting the next a little campaign. Long-winded, Peter. It's not fair to beat up on people who ask you questions.
Sorry.
We got time for one last one. Anyone? Yes, over there.
Which energy source do you think will replace oil?
I think wind, solar are two of the most prominent ones. There's enough wind and enough solar out there that can, in fact, replace it. And that's not a quote from me. That's from J. Boone Pickens, who, when he announced a couple years ago he was going to get into the wind energy sector, and tried and unfortunately failed because of some political obstacles that were put in his way. I think biofuels, I think Brazil has pointed out that that is an effective alternative. Those are three of the most readily available ones that are there now to be used today. There are others being developed in labs that I think in due course will also be readily available. But I think those three can be utilized today, are being utilized today, but not in enough capacity.
There, because we're getting to the end, but before we go, Peter, we have...
And I just want to let you know, I have a book launch here on the 24th in the Burton Room, and you're all invited. The drink and food is on me.
And the book is on sale, as you know. And Peter will be sitting here for a little longer. If you want to bring any copies of his book up for signatures, do come along. And we have Peter after you reach over this side. The T-shirt. But given, thank you.